Hi, podcast listeners. It's Doug Fabrizio here. Over the last 2 months, the Radio West Book Club has read 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. The book follows the fate of the Buendias family and brought the term magical realism into popular use. The book club met recently to discuss the novel and to hear from Dr. Alejandro Quinn. He's an associate professor of Spanish and Latin American Studies at the University of Utah. Our executive producer, Christy Miners, led the discussion.
So, Solitude was published in 1967 in Buenos Aires, Argentina, when the author was still a relatively unknown Colombian writer living in Mexico City. Of course, Garcia Marquez had already written 4 novels and several short stories. He was a popular journalist as well, but only with the publication of this novel did he become the major literary figure that we recognize today. Months before the novel was released, some sections had already been published in Argentine newspapers, creating a great deal of popular expectation. So when it finally appeared in local bookstores, the first print run was sold out within a day, followed then by many reprints, translations, and finally, with time, by global recognition. Achieving a rare balance between commercial success and critical acclaim, Solitude is now widely regarded as one of the essential literary works of the 20th century and the Western canon, and certainly the key work of what is known as the Latin American literary boom of the 1960s, a group of very talented writers that included, for example, Peruvian Mario Vargas Llosa, Argentine Julio Cortázar, Mexican Carlos Fuentes, Brazilian Clarice Lispector, among others. And the novel would also be the main reason why Garcia Marquez was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1982. Now, how do we explain this remarkable trajectory for a novel coming out of Latin America in the 1960s? Well, there are significant historical reasons behind the book's success, and I will mention a few. One reason might, in fact, be geopolitical. As we know, beginning in the 1950s, a wave of decolonization movements broke out across the Third World. Western colonial rule in Africa, in Asia, in the Americas was challenged, and new nations emerged in these areas of the globe. This process of decolonization proclaimed new ideals of independence and national self-determination. And in Latin America, it coincided with what is arguably the most influential political event of the 20th century for the region, the 1959 Cuban Revolution. An event that pushed Latin America to the center of world politics during the Cold War, while also drawing global interest to the region. This explains, to some extent, why so much attention was being paid to all sorts of cultural products and intellectual trends coming out of Latin America at the time, including, of course, the literature produced by the new narrators. The underlying assumption here being that there was a certain correlation between the political significance of the Cuban Revolution and the aesthetic innovations of the literary boom that Garcia Marquez's work epitomizes. Thus, there were important geopolitical conditions that partially account not only for Solitude's immediate positive reception, but also for the growing popularity of Latin American literature worldwide. And other important factors could be added to this context. For instance, the expansion of the Spanish language publishing industry, the consolidation of an educated middle class in the region, and again, the emergence of this group of very talented authors who produce highly innovative works by blending Latin American history and popular culture with the legacy of Euro-American modernist aesthetics. And I'm referring here to the fact that Garcia Marquez and all the boom narrators were influenced by authors such as Franz Kafka, Virginia Woolf, William Faulkner. William Faulkner was very, very important for Garcia Marquez. He considered him his master, James Joyce, and so on. Okay. But as important as they are, these contextual determinations still don't paint the complete picture of solitude's remarkable trajectory. And for that, we, of course, need to consider the novel's qualities as a literary text. The novel, you probably recall, unfolds as a family saga, taking the reader through the life of several generations of the Buendía family in the fictional town of Macondo. Chronologically, it loosely extends from the mid-19th century to the 1960s, and anyone familiar with Colombian history would easily recognize important episodes in the country's history. For example, the 19th century civil wars between conservatives and liberals. In the novel, these wars are led by Colonel Aureliano Buendía, the main character of the first half of 100 Years of Solitude. Other episodes include the early 20th century period of conservative hegemony in the country, the neocolonial model of exploitation brought on by the Banana Company, also that is the US-based United Fruit Company. Now, such historical events resonate in varied ways with those of many other Latin American countries, and it has often been mentioned that when the novel first appeared, readers throughout the region could recognize aspects of their own national history despite contextual differences. But there is yet another, perhaps more universal feature of the book, one where history overlaps with myth. At this narrative level, the novel reads as a mythical tale of creation and destruction. In fact, the founding of Macondo seems to coincide with the creation of the world itself. For as we learn in the book's opening pages, when the village was established, and I quote here, the world was so recent that many things lacked names, and in order to indicate them, it was necessary to point. Similarly, the town's founding couple, José Arcadio and Úrsula, stand for the primordial couple whence all of humankind descends. And by the time we reach the novel's final chapter, a hurricane wind of biblical proportions wipes out Macondo from the face of the earth, thus fulfilling the prophecy recorded in Melquiades's manuscripts, the old parchments that contain Macondo's history, as Aureliano Babilonia, the last of the Buendías, manages to decipher the documents. It is through the narrative interplay between history and myth that Macondo turns all at once into an allegory for Colombia, into a symbol for Latin America, and into an image of the world or the universe itself. Solitude's wide-reaching appeal among diverse audiences, at least in part, may lay in the fact that the novel lends itself to be read simultaneously as a national novel, as a continental fiction, and as a cosmological story of creation and destruction. Now, let us linger for a moment, and this is the second part of my presentation. Let us linger for a moment on the powerful ending of 100 Years of Solitude and examine the potential implication of the demolition of Macondo for a contemporary reading of the novel. Why did García Márquez set out to destroy the fictional universe that he had so carefully crafted? And what challenges does this narrative destruction pose to us as readers? Let us remember that in the novel's final pages, after the banana workers' strike, the military repression of the protests, and the four-year flood that followed, Macondo has become a desolate town, and Aureliano Babilonia, the last of the Buendías, has finally found, after several years of intense study, the key to decipher the manuscripts that obsessed many generations of his family, the old parchments written by Melquiades the magician. And I quote here from the novel, Aureliano knew, this is in the very last pages of the book, Aureliano knew that his face was written in Melquiades' parchment. He found them intact, and right there, standing, he began to decipher them aloud. It was the history of the family of Macondo, written by Melquiades 100 years ahead of time. Macondo was already a fearful whirlwind of dust and rubble spun by the wrath of the biblical hurricane when Aureliano began to decipher the instant he was living, deciphering it as he was living it. He had already understood that he would never leave that room, for it was foreseen that the city of mirrors would be wiped out by the wind, and so on. There is a remarkable coincidence between Macondo's destruction on the one hand and the act of reading and studying that leads the character's understanding of his own history on the other. But the crucial point here, found midway through the passage, is when Aureliano comes to the realization that he is deciphering the instant that he is living. For it is precisely then that he awakens to the here and now that positions him at the crossroads of the present. Only then we, the readers, also learn that the novel we just read corresponds to Melquiades's all manuscripts. And as a result, we end up in the same position as Aureliano in the story. That is, we are confronted with the destruction of Macondo as an event related to our own here and now. It seems to me, in other words, that what the destruction of Macondo demands from us is a reflective relationship with the present. And every time we reach Solitude's final pages, we are thus faced with the same inescapable demand, the need to dig into the present so as to grasp the historical condition, but also the dangers and promises of our individual and collective histories of our own present time. To conclude, let me play with the suggestion that the end of 100 years of solitude, the moment when a relationship with the present is revealed, makes it possible to understand the event of destruction in two alternative ways, as a material catastrophe and as a figure of justice and emancipation. Any reader of Solitude will immediately notice that life in Macondo is caught up in a circular process. Character names are repeated throughout the novel, the Aurelianos, the José Arcadios. Family situations reappear once and again. Liberal and conservative governments use the same authoritarian tactics. Political violence is never ending. History repeats itself in Macondo. But all this fatalistic circularity, as we already know, will come to an end once Aureliano manages to decipher in the manuscripts. And the character's particular portrayal in the novel is instructive in this regard. Unlike his old ancestor, Colonel Aureliano Buendía, the novel's mythic military man, Babylonia, Aureliano Babylonia, is defined instead by different activities. He is a bookworm, a young studious learning on the search for truth, who spends his life in libraries, bookstores, and study rooms. Rather than a specialist or an intellectual in any traditional sense, he can more properly be characterized as a student. And just as Babylonia is the only person in town who will keep alive the memory of the banana workers' strike, which is the popular demand for justice and equality in the novel, he will also be the only character that comes to a real understanding of the circularity governing life in Macondo. We can perhaps infer from this that Solitude's fictional world is brought down by the decisive intervention of a student, he who, by discerning the parchment and keeping the strike's legacy, effectively deactivates or destroys the spiral of injustices and senseless repetitions in Macondo as he becomes aware of his time. Yet, as mentioned before, Macondo's downfall can also be read as a sign of destruction in a more literal sense, that is, as a catastrophic devastation that casts the relationship with the present in a far darker light. This is destruction and extinction on a planetary scale, one that eerily resonates with the natural phenomena associated today with human-induced climate change, global warming, natural catastrophe, deforestation, animal extinctions, and so on. In this regard, the end of the Buendía family of Macondo is tantamount to the end of the world. When reading the novel as a climate change narrative, it is clear that Macondo's decline can be traced back to the town's transition to a fossil fuel economy, the construction of the railroad, and the implementation of large-scale monoculture farming once the banana company settles in the town. And the more Macondo moves in this direction, the more evident the signs of climate disarray become in the novel. Birds drop dead due to extreme heat. Rain falls for 4 years straight, causing the town to flood. A multitude of insects, rats, and reptiles colonize the Buendía's house in confusion. And the wrath of the hurricane wind ultimately seals Macondo's faith as a disaster of civilizational proportions. Surprisingly, the novel we were taught to read as a shining example of fantasy and magical realism may turn out to be more realist than magical from this perspective. Solitude's contribution in this regard may consist in the fact that it also narrates destruction as experienced by an entire collective, thus allowing us, perhaps, to reimagine and assume those environmental challenges as a common concern. And that is all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Oh my gosh. Now all I want to do is talk about the weather patterns. It's something we hadn't actually discussed much on. In fact, I don't think it came up at all. Well, I have a question to get us kicked off. This is a little bit about just when you were referring earlier to you're from Colombia, obviously. We know Marcus is Colombia. I wondered, how is this book seen in his native land? What place does it hold in Colombia?
Well, it's the most important literary piece producing in Colombia. And it has been, it's celebrated, you know, by popular sector, but also by official sector. You know, I mean, there is a consensus around García Márquez in many ways. And this is very telling, especially for a country such as Colombia, who has experienced a civil war for more than 60 years, you know. And I mean, García Márquez and 100 Years of Solitude and Macondo have become metaphors for a meeting point for Colombians somehow, right? A way of coming together, okay? But the problem with that also is that, I mean, the novel has been canonized and has become such a monument that we have stopped reading it more critically, you know? So it has become part of official culture, part of national culture. Everyone celebrates 100 years of solitude and García Márquez. Yet at the same time, we are not actually reading García Márquez.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true of a lot of canonized literature. We stop seeing, we have a tendency to almost revere it so much we really stop seeing it. Is there something in your readings that you wish people would pay a little bit more attention to?
I think one of the problems with García Márquez's reception is that people tend to focus on the magic and magical realism and tend to forget those more critical aspects of his writing and the novel, you know. For example, in 100 Years of Solitude, we have this reference to the banana workers' strike, you know, which was a real episode in Colombian history that took place in 1928, and the massacre was real. And actually, this episode had been forgotten in Colombia until the publication of 100 Years of Solitude. And now we are again discussing, in many ways, you know, what happened in those years, you know, and the legacy of the strike and all of that because of the novel. So the novel actually shed light on different episodes of Colombian history from a more critical perspective. So yeah, my take on this is that a critical reading of García Márquez is necessary in order to recover a more productive, you know, perspective from his work, not just the celebration and the monumentalization that we are used to.
Well, and truthfully, when you think about it, that gives more respect to the book anyway. I mean, to set it on a shelf and just admire it doesn't really do it the mm-hmm. justice that it deserves, but you rather to engage with it.
I have a question.
Oh, great, Janice, please.
Yes, since it creates the town and then over 100 years, it slowly you see the destruction of the town, where is their hopefulness then? Or am I missing something? It seems like a creation and then a destruction and we're back to zero.
Yes, thank you for your question. I think that's very important because it demands a reinterpretation on the idea of destruction. I mean, we can see destruction, the destruction of Macondo as, you know, as a negative catastrophe, as devastation, as the end of the world, you know. But I think there is a more critical aspect of destruction here, which is, you know, looking critically at your own history. That is what, in my opinion, the last character is trying to do. He is deciphering history. He's trying to understand his own present, and he's destroying that history of probably violence and injustices somehow because he's reading critically at that last moment. Okay. So I would like to also emphasize this other aspect of destruction, understood as the potential for critical thinking, for emancipation, for looking at things differently. That is what, in my opinion, happens in the last part of 100 years of solitude.
Josh, I'm not sure if it was you or Stephen that brought this up, but it was one of my favorite questions that we talked about, which is what is love in this book? Do you see examples of what love really means in this text? We see a lot of passion. I don't know if love and passion always go together for Márquez, but the relationships are difficult and often start in difficult ways. And I even think about, like, say, the relationship between Rebecca and Amaranta, you know, who seem to have so much amity between each other. And yet I also saw glimpses of perhaps some real, there was a connection there, whether that was love or something else, I'm not sure. But how do you see love in this novel?
That's an interesting question. It's difficult sometimes to find love here. I mean, there's passion, there is intensity in these characters, you know. But the problem sometimes with these characters and with this fictional world is that we witness, you know, a group of individuals that are very obsessed and self-centered. Mm. Pretty much everyone is following their own obsessions, their own desires, especially the male characters, right? And they don't care about what happens, you know? And sometimes love is quite difficult to find. Because of this self-centered nature of many of the characters, right? So I remember one of the episodes that in which you can find like true intense love in the narrative is between the mother of Aureliano Babilonia and Mauricio Babilonia, you know. They at some point, I forgot, I mean, there are so many characters, sometimes it's difficult to recall each of them. But there is a moment of probably like sincere and true love, but they are separated by Fernanda del Carpio, right? Because of course, Mauricio Babilonia, he's coming from a working class background, you know? And he's not accepted by the Buendía family. Yeah. So they need to, you know, to end that relationship, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I thought perhaps because of the nature of incest, that the community originally is very isolated and insular and hard to break out of that or to trust someone outside of that family.
Yeah, I mean, and incest is part of the self-referentiality and circularity of these individuals and this community, you know? And it accounts for the isolation of Macondo itself, you know, and the isolation of the Buendía, right? So it seems to me that incest and what I've been talking about, the self-centered nature of the characters, actually reinforce this conception of solitude that we see in the novel, right? I mean, they cannot, this is a society, a family, they cannot actually relate sincerely with the community at large somehow, right? And they are obsessed, right? In incest sort of reinforces that isolation, right? And that aspect.
In addition to that repetition that we get, there's one of the things that I was really struck by was what a name means and what that makes you or doesn't make you, particularly with the twins. You know, potentially they swapped identities, and did they trick fate in swapping identities? Is what was it? Was it their name or was it who they are? And I wondered if you have much to say about naming and how a name is an identity in this book, because it seems like Marquez is having some fun with namings.
And with, I mean, confusing readers with all this,
right? And the
repetition of these names. Yeah. My way of understanding the naming and the repetition of names is that it adds to the circularity of the narrative, right? And it adds to the topic of incest. You know, it adds to the idea that history repeats itself in Macondo. Okay. So that is why, you know, I think names are part of a narrative device that Garcia Marquez is using to reinforce, you know, to cement this idea of constant repetition, you know, at the level of many family generations in the novel, right?
Your comment about the self-centered male characters, I thought was interesting, because that is particularly true for the men in this book. They mm-hmm. do tend to be very selfish. They do tend to be very self-centered. The female characters have a little more nuance. And I wonder if you could talk about those differences between how Marquez is writing his male figures and how he's writing his female figures. And I wonder, is he doing this purposefully? Is he using the male figures for a very specific narrative device, and the female figures? Female figures in some ways sort of keep the story moving in a different kind of way than the male figures do.
Yes, I mean, this is a constant in Garcia Marquez's narrative, you know, and it has been noted that, I mean, the way he portrays male and female characters is very different, and they all have different characteristics. For example, men are portrayed as impulsive, imaginative. They are dreamers, and they are particularly obsessed, right? Think of the first José Arcadio and his, you know, obsession with science and invention and modernity, right? Think of Colonel Aureliano Buendía and his obsession with war, et cetera, et cetera. Female characters in Garcia Marquez's narrative usually tend to be, I mean, this is not always the case, but usually tend to be more practical, down to earth, more rational also, right? So, and women usually repair the damages and the destruction provoked by men in Marquez's narrative. You can see that, you know? I mean, in 100 Years of Solitude, Ursula is complaining of it all the time, you know? He's trying to keep everything together, but she cannot do it with a bunch of obsessive people that moves around her house, right? And I mean, there are maybe some exceptions, maybe Remedios the Beauty, right? she might not have this rational, down to earth characteristic, but women tend to be portrayed in that way in Garcia Marquez's narrative, and particularly I think in 100 Years of Solitude, right? So they try to keep the world together, you know, while men are usually obsessed and they are kind of out there, you know, creating problems for the community and for the family.
Yeah, the character that I don't think we discussed much throughout our reading, who becomes so much more important at the end of the book, is Melquiades.
Yeah, does anyone remember who Melquiades was?
Oh yeah. Is he a gypsy?
Yeah, he's the magician, the gypsy that brings the new inventions to Macondo. He's one of the central characters.
And he dies and come back to life or not?
Yeah. And you know, at the meta narrative level, he is the author of 100 Years of Solitude. He's the writer of the text that we are reading, but we only realize that at the end of the novel, right? When Aureliano Babilonia, the last of the Buendias, realizes that that Melquiades had written the history of the family. So actually the book that we are reading, you know, is at the interior, internal to the fiction, has been written by Melquiades, right? He is the narrative voice in the text, but we only discover that at the end of the novel. And also interesting is that he's the gypsy, he's a magician, and he represents the first connection between Macondo and the outside world. Okay. But you know, the population of Macondo and the Buendia family, they at first they don't really understand these new inventions that are coming from the modern world, right? That is part of the isolation of this community, right? So they see the magnet, you know, at the beginning of the first chapter in José Arcadio Buendia, he wants to use the magnet to unearth gold, right, and things like that. So they give different uses to traditional tools, right, to traditional elements. And Melquiades is bringing that to the city. But he's a very important character because he is the author, you know, he's the author of 100 Years of Solitude, right? The implicit author, as we say usually in literary criticism, right?
Yeah, in a sense, it sort of alters his character in a way from being the prophet to almost being the god in this community, because he'll appear and he'll introduce new technology and new ideas, and then he'll go away for a while, and then he'll return to see how things are going. And then it's his death that is the first burial in Macondo. And so the opening lines of the book say that no one really belongs to a place until someone's buried in the ground. And then the first person to be buried there is Melquiades himself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like God is dead.
But he still maintains, in the sense that he has created this entire fictional world, he's acting as God, right? You know, as a creator somehow. He still maintains a kind of a spectral presence throughout the book, right? I mean, he never really goes away. You know? And we see him return in writing, right? As the author, he is God, but he's the author as well, right? He's the creator of the world, but he's the creator of the narrative that we are reading, yeah?
I did want to ask you, Dr. Quinn, for those of us who are new to Marquez, you know, this is by far his most famous work for most of us, but what else should we read? If we'd like to go, you know, on to a next work, what would you recommend?
I would recommend his novellas, his short narrative, you know, as a starting point. For example, No One Writes to the Colonel, which is a novel that a novella that he wrote in Paris. He was very young, 24, 25 years old, and he was exiled in Paris, and he had the time to write this beautiful novel that even after the publication of 100 Years of Solitude, García Márquez himself considered as his best literary piece, No One Writes to the Colonel, right? And it was published in 1956, I guess, around, or 57. Another novel that I would recommend is Chronicle of a Death Foretold. No, it's a short novel, a novella, and it's a very, very powerful a late narrative of García Márquez, right? And of course, you also have these other important works, such as Love in the Times of Cholera,
which
has become very popular recently for obvious reasons, you know, with the pandemic, and people have started, you know, making connections with the novel. Another novel is The Autumn of the Patriarch, which is interesting in the sense that after the publication of Solitude, García Márquez was so overwhelmed by the success of the novel, right, that he didn't know what to do, but he knew that he couldn't continue writing with the same style. He could not continue this formula that he used in 100 Years of Solitude. So he needed to renovate himself, right? And that's when he wrote The Autumn of the Patriarch, which is what we called in Latin American literary studies a dictatorship novel. Oh. It's a very experimental style. It's very different from 100 Years of Solitude. It's very exciting too. Right? It has great humor as well. I truly recommend it.
There's a paragraph that I found, and I could go get it, but it says something to the effect that we're not dealing with reality, or people refuse to accept the reality of the massacre and therefore it didn't happen. And that kind of related to me a lot of our current United States political situation.
Yeah, that's, I mean, the banana massacre is the main episode in 100 Years of Solitude. Oh, yeah. It marks a before and an after, you know, because the decline of Macondo, it starts, you know, with the arrival of the banana company and the massacre, you know. The decline of Macondo begins with the massacre, right? And so, that's an incredible chapter, you know? And you probably noticed that the language that García Márquez is using in that particular chapter is very different from the language he uses in the rest of the novel. This is more matter of fact. This is more journalistic. And he is, you know, referring to actual events. You know, he's citing actual names, you know, he refers to the military commander who, you know, led the massacre. And you know, this episode is quite important. And let us remember also that García Márquez was, by profession, a journalist, right? He, in addition to being a fiction writer, he was a journalist. And this is probably the most, I would say, journalistic moment in the text, at least when he narrates the massacre. After that, again, you know, comes oblivion, right? Everybody forgets that this happened, right? Nobody wants to talk about the massacre, the banana workers massacre. And that is, that resonates with what actually happened in Colombian history, because that was probably the largest popular mobilization in Colombian history. And after the massacre, you know, it was covered, you know, by official history, right? It never happened. So what is really important about this episode in the novel is that García Márquez recovered this for the historical memory of the nation. Now we are talking again about the banana workers strike in Colombia after the publication of 100 Years of Solitude. Yeah, definitely. So you see how literature sometimes can, you know, influence political debates and social debates. I think that it's a clear example.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your expertise. Thank you for sharing your love and knowledge about this author and this book. This was a particularly special one that we've read. So thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you, Christy. It was a pleasure to be here and to chat with you. Thanks a lot.
That's Alejandro Quinn. He's an associate professor of Spanish and Latin American studies at the University of Utah, along with Christy Miners, our executive producer, talking about 100 Years of Solitude. If you're interested in becoming a member of the Radio West Book Club, you can go to our website, radiowest.org, for more information. We'd love to have you. In June and July, we're going to be reading Born a Crime by Trevor Noah.